Hey friends, this is Michael Bohm with Youth Apologetics Training. Today we're going to keep going on this series about Seventh-day Adventists and what they believe. We're actually going to start getting into the history of this movement and how it got started. This is really important. It's interesting content, but it's really important in understanding where they're coming from when you communicate with these groups. Also, there's some other groups who have spun off some of the characters we're going to talk about today, or at least one of the characters. And so that's going to be interesting as well. Now, I'm still recording this on September 13th of 2013, and now it is 12:40. The sun has come out, but the floods are still raging. We do have more rain on the way, unfortunately. Over the next few days, we're supposed to get more rain, so who knows how this is all going to pan out. But anyway, friends, let's just go ahead and jump right in here and start talking about this movement. It started with a guy back in the 1800s known as William Miller. Now, William Miller, he started out as a deist. Okay, do you know what a deist is? Basically, deism is the idea that there is a God, but he just kind of wound this clock up and let it go. Okay, this God is a non-personal, unpersonal God who got this world going, stepped back, and doesn't want anything to do with us. Okay, so it's hard to know anything about this God. He doesn't reveal himself. There are no miracles, that type of thing. Okay. He started out in deism, but then he converted to Christianity in 1816, and he became a Baptist. He started studying, basically, if you could say it this way, apologetics on how to reach those who were caught up in deism, okay, deists. He wanted to find ways where he could reach these deists. Also, along those lines, he also became very involved in the second coming, talking about end times and when Christ would return. Now, this is important because he came up with a theory about when Christ would return that had a very large impact on Seventh-day Adventist teachings, okay? William Miller did not start the Seventh-day Adventist. He just had some ideas that Ellen G. White picked up and ended up in their theology later on, okay? But William Miller, reading Daniel 8, chapter 8, verse 14, came up with a theory that Jesus would return somewhere around 1843 to 1844. Now, he came up with it this way. Let me read Daniel 8:14 really quick. And actually, I'm going to start on verse 13 just to give you a little bit of context. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. All right, so William Miller came up with this theory that basically Jesus was going to return in 2,300 years from the rebuilding of the sanctuary, from the time that Jerusalem was rebuilt. Okay, so this decree was issued to rebuild Jerusalem in 457 BC. All right, you follow me so far? And you count 2,300 years into the future, and you land somewhere around 1843 to 1844, all right? And this led to the great disappointment because everybody was expecting Jesus to return on that day. So, like so many failed prophecies about Jesus coming on this day or that day, you know, Harold Camping, the watchtowers had many failed prophecies, and so, in fact, I believe the Watchtower was expecting Jesus to return on 1844 too as well, if I remember right. And so you had all these people who quit their jobs, sold everything, or whatever, and they're standing on the roof of their houses in all white linen, okay, just standing there with their arms up, just ready for Christ to show up, okay? And it's so sad. How embarrassing too, right? all because of a teaching of man. You know, we're not supposed to know the day or hour. Jesus didn't even know. All right? And so they're all standing on the roof of their house or whatever. Jesus doesn't come back. And that day went down in history as the great disappointment. Oh, I guess I didn't say what that day was. He finally came up with a date and declared that it was going to happen on October 22nd, 1844. He finally gave in to the temptation and just laid out an exact day. Now, after this happened, the Millerites, as they were called, okay, those who followed William Miller, the Millerites, they broke up after that day. The whole thing just fell apart, okay? He stopped pushing his prophecies. He realized that he had played the role of a false prophet. He threw up. He threw in the towel and gave up on his ministry, right? But that didn't stop some of his followers. So now enter in Hiram Edson. So on October 22nd, there was the great disappointment. The morning after October 23rd of 1844, we had Hiram Edson. And he was walking through a cornfield and he was praying and he was, you know, he was asking God, why did this happen? Like, how did we mess this up? And then he claims he had a vision. He received new light. And in this vision, he was informed that Jesus was not to show up in 1844, but rather he moved from one part of heaven to a different part of heaven. He moved into the sanctuary, the most holy place, to cleanse the sanctuary. And so now Jesus goes into this most holy place and the investigative judgment begins. And in this investigative judgment, we're going to talk about this quite a bit, Jesus is reviewing all the records of heaven. He's trying to find out who's been naughty and who's been nice. He's reviewing all the records in heaven. He must review all of them and complete this investigative judgment before he can return. And so, like I mentioned yesterday, this would be that second phase of the atonement. In a sense, it is that, you know, when Jesus was on the cross and he yelled out, Tetelestai, he yelled out, it is finished. Well, apparently he wasn't finished because he had to enter into the most holy place and start working out this apparently pretty extensive project of reviewing all these records. Now, Hiram Edson, he was one of the original founders of the Seventh-day Adventist movement, okay? There was actually three, maybe four, really notable characters in the beginning or foundation of this movement. William Miller, he just came up with this idea that Jesus was going to return in 1844, and then he stopped his career as a false prophet. He gave that up, and these other characters stepped in, picked up the ball, and ran with it. One of the other people that I want to talk about is Joseph Bates. All right, Joseph Bates was a seaman. And as I was studying up about this Joseph Bates, one of the most important things that I learned about him is his mother was one of the daughters, was the daughter of Barnabas Rye of Sandwich, Massachusetts. And so next time you are having a pastrami on rye, I think you need to think back to Joseph Bates, his mother, or rather his grandmother. Okay, that was completely useless. Anyway, sorry about that. Joseph Bates also believed in this investigative judgment. He picked up that ball. He heard about this investigative judgment idea of Hiram Edson. And Joseph Bates, he was a strong believer that us New Testament believers should be following the Sabbath. And so he was the one that really brought this whole Sabbatarian concept to the Seventh-day Adventists. He was also the guy that really brought in the health conscious attitude to the Seventh-day Adventists. And honestly, again, I really don't have too much of a problem with that. He was a vegetarian. He was, you know, he noticed on his ship that those who participated in alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, or overindulged in meats, or unclean meats for that matter, had poor health. And those who, well, whether on purpose or accidentally, seemed to be eating better, well, they had better health. Okay? And he noticed that. And so, as Joseph Bates and Hiram Edson and Ellen G. White, as we're going to talk about here in a minute, as they came together, he brought those two elements to the mix, the Sabbath and the kosher laws, in a sense. And I don't know if I mentioned this, but many, not all, but many Seventh-day Adventists are actually vegetarians as well. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. And so Joseph Bates became known as the Apostle of the Sabbath. Ellen G. White, is by far the most influential character in the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And for the most part, we're going to focus on her as we're talking about the beliefs in this movement, because she's the one that really got this thing rolling. Now, Ellen White, born on November 26, 1827. She died July 16th of 1915. When she was young in school, somebody threw a rock at her and hit her clean in the face. I mean, nasty. It messed up her nose and it put her in a coma for several weeks. Now, the reason why I bring this up is it's quite possible that some of her visions or all of her visions had something to do with this because, well, as later physicians note, many different physicians diagnosed her with brain injuries later on in life. And so there is possibly that playing a role in her life. But Ellen G. White had many different visions. And we're going to talk about some of them. Some of them even include prophecies. Now, when she would have these visions, there is a J.N. Loughborough, I have no idea if I'm saying that name right, and her husband, James White, they listed some things that kind of describe what these visions looked like when she was having them, like how she behaved. And I want to read these to you because they're a little fascinating. What do you guys think? One of the things they wrote down, one, in passing into vision, she gives three enrapturing shouts of glory, which echo and re-echo the second and especially the third, fainter but more thrilling than the first, the voice resembling that of one quite a distance from you and just going out of hearing. Second, for a few seconds, she would swoon, having no strength. This is kind of creepy. Then she would be instantly filled with superhuman strength, sometimes rising to her feet and walking about the room. She frequently moved hands, arms, and head in gestures that were free and graceful, but to whatever position she moved a hand or arm, it could not be hindered nor controlled by even the strongest person. In 1845, she held her parents' 18.5-pound family Bible in her outstretched left hand for half an hour. She weighed 80 pounds at the time. Now, that is a little interesting. Now, all right. Hear where I'm coming from, friends. She uttered some prophecies in these visions, and these prophecies turned out to be false prophecies, all right? So we can tell right now that these visions were not from the Lord. And to all of my Seventh-day Adventist listeners out there, hey, I love you guys. I don't mean you any harm. I just want you to know the truth. She's uttered many false prophecies, and most Seventh-day Adventists are not aware of that. We're going to discuss those in this series. Now, we know from various characters in the Bible who were overcome with demons that they also had superhuman strength, and it was very difficult to control them. There's the instance where the demon-possessed individual came upon the seven sons of Sceva, You know, the ones that ran out the door in their skivvies? No, sorry. The seven sons of Sceva, they were overpowered and beat up pretty bad by somebody demon-possessed. We also have the guy who was in chains running around in the graveyard that Jesus delivered. Now, friends, there are many accounts nowadays of people who have some kind of demonic possession upon them and also have superhuman strength. I'm not going to stand behind any of those accounts because, honestly, I wasn't there. And some of them are probably bogus. I don't know, okay? But I wasn't there. I will trust what the Bible says. And so we can say that there are times when something comes upon a person and they have superhuman strength. So anyway, number three, listen to this. She did not breathe during the entire period of a vision that ranged from 15 minutes to 3 hours. Yet her pulse beat regularly and her countenance remained pleasant as in the natural state. That is bizarre. I mean, if what they're saying is true, and really we don't know, again, we weren't there, there was no cameras, but not breathing for 15 minutes or 3 hours? Wow. Okay, number four, her eyes were always open without blinking. Her head was raised, looking upward with a pleasant expression, as if staring intently at some distant object. Several physicians at different times conducted tests to check her lack of breathing and other physical phenomenon. So she's not breathing and she's not blinking. Five, she was utterly unconscious of everything transpiring around her and viewed herself as removing from this world and in the presence of heavenly beings. Six, when she came out of a vision, all seemed total darkness, whether in the daytime or well-lighted room at night. She would exclaim with a long-drawn sigh as she took her first natural breath, "Dark." I'm sorry, I probably did a horrible impression of her. She was then limp and strengthless. Again, that was from her husband, James White. That's what he said she would do during these visions. So I'm going to stop right there. I went a little bit long, not too much long. But anyway, friends, if you like these podcasts, you like the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast, I urge you to subscribe to my Youth Apologetics Training feed. I know many of you out there are listening from the Apologetics feed. Come out and subscribe to the Youth Apologetics Training feed. That way you're going to get all of my podcasts. Some of them do not have apologetics in the title structure. Okay, so this will get you all of my podcasts, and it'll help me get my message out to more people. The more people that subscribe, the better ranking I receive within iTunes and these other podcast directory type services. And, well, it just helps get the message out. So, yeah. Also, if you guys like to chat, you can catch me on Google+, Facebook, Twitter, and now the newer website, myworldviewpage.com. That one is put up by Brandon House, who also has an amazing podcast that is indispensable. If you're not listening to that, you need to check out Brandon House and Worldview Weekend, as well as another podcast that comes from his website as well, Chris Pinto, Noise of Thunder. Two indispensable podcasts. But anyway, Brandon House put together a website just like Facebook, but it is just for conservative Christians. It is growing by leaps and bounds every day. Many people are joining up. It's a pretty good site. They're doing a great job. It's a little early and it does have some glitches, but by the time you listen to this podcast, they've probably ironed out most of those glitches. Check it out. Anyway, I love you guys and I'll see you tomorrow.